First Friday is like no other day of the month in Kansas City. The smell of food cooking, music blaring in the night air, galleries with doors wide open, and a gorgeous sunset over the vibrant streets of the Crossroads District. But what did this part of town look like back when they called it Leedyville? What did it look like before Jim Leedy, the man they named it for? I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll learn about a new documentary telling the story of the Crossroads itself and the story of Jim Leedy and his contribution to the local arts community as well as his own creative formation. Learn the backstory of the Crossroads District and meet Jim Leedy, a true KC visionary and the subject of a new local documentary. That's coming up on Central Standard. You won't want to miss this one after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. The legendary artist Jim Leedy gives this piece of advice to any budding artist. Always be conscious of where you've been when heading in a new direction. Jim Leedy's been lots of places and is known for constantly heading in new directions. Those directions are now documented in an upcoming film. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We now welcome the one and only Jim Leedy and Kevin McGraw, the filmmaker behind Leedy, the documentary several years in the making, premiering tomorrow, Friday, August 31st, at the Screenland Crossroads. Thank you for coming to the show, Mr. Leedy.
Thank you.
Mr. McGraw, Quick Draw McGraw.
How are you?
Thank you for coming to the show. I bet you've never heard that before.
Just a few times.
Now, before we get into Mr. Leedy's life and the meat of today's program, Mr. Leedy, you graciously invited us to your studio to see where you create. So we're going to take a listen back now to our visit, and we learned that your relationship to the materials that you make up in your art is best described as a collaboration between man and nature. So let's take a listen. We are in the studio of the legendary Jim Leedy in the painting/party room. Just had a raucous party here last night from some visitors from Omaha. What's unique about this room that makes this the painting room versus the other room that you enter when you come into the larger studio, which is the ceramics and sculptures room? What's significant about this room?
Well, my clay work in the other room is extremely dirty and dusty. And so I try to separate that, even though I go back and forth. The paintings, I try to keep away from the dust. And so that's why this room is a painting room. And it's also sort of like a place where I have people, you know, and sometimes I spend the night. And my wife is very good, Molly, who is standing here. And she helps me take care of the place. Well, she's saying no, and because she's not proud of the dirt, and she's right, but she does help me in many ways.
Can we bring Molly over here? Can we get you over here, yeah. Molly? How is it to be in this space with your husband when he's working or getting ready to work or he's just got finished working?
Well, this is his space, and I leave it his space. Whatever he does is priority here, and I'm in the background unless he needs an assistant.
And what do you do in assistant capacities?
It would overflow your show, but I have some experience with clay, so I can assist him with his clay work, and I know how he works, so I can sometimes anticipate his needs in any of his endeavors.
She's very good at that, you know. It's like I can say, oh, Molly, will you hand me? Oh, thank you. She's handed it to me already. So she anticipates. And she travels we travel together, and I do a lot of work in the last few years in China. And she's my number one assistant. You know, I couldn't do it without her. She's always there with me.
So when you begin to paint, what is the start of your process like? What do you have any rituals that you go through when you begin to paint, or you just do it?
Yeah, I just do it. In fact, I kind of like to forget everything I have known or done, so that each one is a new exploration, a new adventure. So someone says, well, you know, do you have a you have an idea when you start. Sometimes I might, but I like a open canvas and paint and my hands and brushes, and I just start working. I let the painting tell me what to do. I don't tell the painting. It tells me. I put a stroke down. The painting will say, well, don't you need another stroke over here, you know? I say, yeah. What else do you want? Well, how about putting a red color here? It's okay, I'll try that, you know? It's a collaboration with the material and the surface of the painting. Now, I don't know what that piece is going to look like ever. I have no idea. It evolves. It creates itself, sort of, by telling me what to do.
This studio seems almost to be its own sort of living organism, yeah, by itself, very alive. You got, yeah, skulls, mannequin heads, yeah, and pictures on the wall, African masks, antique, mm-hmm, indigenous art. What is it like to kind of be present with the space as it breathes and lives?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is an organism in its own right. You know, this room lives. But it lives because of what I have done. You know, it's full of things that I love to have around me. My African mask, my Asian objects, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and I was in Taiwan, and I walked into a shop, and there was this vessel that was there, and it had things growing on it from the sea, and it was nature itself. Some artist 1,000 years ago had made the vessel to store something in, they told me, and on the way from China to Taiwan, the ship sank, and that vessel lay in the bottom of the sea for 1,000 years. And someone found it, and it has sea creatures growing on it and so on. And it was much more beautiful now than it was when it was made, because it has collaborated with nature. And that's what I try to do in my own work, you know. I feel like I'm collaborating with nature. Jackson Pollock once said, I am nature, and I understand that completely, because we are nature, and what we do comes out of what we've been, where we're going, what in the world around us. I really, really do try to wed with the world, with the universe. When I rarely ever use paint out of a tube. I make my own paint. I get dirt and I get glues and I get natural colors, and so the painting itself is an organic thing, just like the hillside that might, you know, wash off, and where the water's been and left the rocks exposed and so on. I think those things are beautiful. And I think we can't compete with nature, you know, but we can try to be as close to nature as possible.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We've been listening back to our visit to Jim Leedy's studio in the Crossroads District, and the legendary artist is joining us now in the studio with dried paint on his hands. He's that dedicated. Dried paint from a painting expedition the night before. We're also joined by Kevin McGraw of Cowbell Productions, the filmmaking collective behind Leedy the Documentary, which is showing this Friday at the Screenland Crossroads. Several years in the making, by the way. Kevin, why was this documentary 7 years to be exact, in the making?
Well, Jim got in a motorcycle wreck. when we started in 2005, we had started filming at Wide Awake Films. My buddy Kevin Worley got us started there, and to introduce me to Matt Hawley, who's the director of this, I have to say, amazing film.
I know that guy. He drinks a lot of coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, Jim had a wreck, like, in early 2007 or even 6 maybe. It wasn't too long after, but it really put us slided down. We stopped with Jim for almost 2 full years while Molly was getting him back into condition. But more than that, I think that was certainly a time that we had to stop. But funding was always, and as always for these kind of projects, they never make money. So you just try to get them done, and that's really my focus, and has been my focus for the last 7 years, is to just get it done. But as you're doing that stuff, you're trying to get. You got to interview this guy. You got to have a talk with that guy. You got to, you know, so much research, so much legwork, and it just takes a lot of time.
Talk about that a little bit, the process of putting it all together, the interviews, the footage, the still photography, the research, tracking everybody down, getting Mr. Leedy himself out of bed, off the couch, out of the studio, off the motorcycle, what have you.
Well, you kind of said it. It's just one of those laborious processes. It just takes so much time to think about what you're going to do. In the very beginning, I started trying to write a script, and I realized pretty quickly that these documentaries kind of write themselves, and it's just a matter of time until you have enough interviews and enough conversations and enough photographs and enough shooting, imaging, and all that stuff that you really start to give yourself the ability to put it together.
Talk about funding. Talk about the Kickstarter campaign for the film, and tell us why you decided to go that route. There's lots of endowments for the arts, lots of people around here who are probably fans of his work, lots of grants for art documentaries or community-oriented documentaries. Tell us about Kickstarter and all the other sort of funding avenues you went down.
Well, I did go early on to try to get grants and to get a grant, and to really win a grant, you need a good grant writer, and they're expensive. I found out. So the Kickstarter thing was mainly something that we decided. I wish it would have been around in 2005 when we started, but it wasn't. So Matt really kind of headed that up and said, you know, I think it might be a good idea to help get some of these hard costs that we're going to incur with closed captioning and the music and the rights to stuff, and making sure that we didn't have to run into any problems with somebody suing us, or we just wanted to make it really clean and really without any feeling or notion that something was going to go that direction in terms of a lawsuit. So the Kickstarter thing is where we're trying to drive people to and to help. We've got a lot of great incentives. We've got great poster that's signed by Jim. We've got a DVD that we offer signed by Jim. We've got a book, his Artists Across Boundaries book that Matthew Kangas wrote in 2000. We're offering that with a DVD. And so there's lots of incentives that you can find on the Kickstarter page. There's even a piece that Jim donated. It's a vessel. It's about 3 feet tall and 15 inches in diameter. It's absolutely beautiful. You can go to the Kickstarter page, and on the update button, you can see that piece, and it's a $20,000 piece, and our full budget for this film on the Kickstarter page is $25,000, and we're not there yet.
Speaking of being not there yet, a man living his life in full every single day, every new day, the man of the hour, Mr. Leedy. What was your reaction, Mr. Leedy, when they came to you and said they wanted to do a film on your life in particular?
I said, no way.
You said, no way.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah, I did. Seriously. I did not want to do it. But Kevin is persuasive, and he kept pushing and pushing, and finally I said, yeah, that's a great idea.
Why did you not want to do it at first?
I just did not want to take the time away from my own creative efforts. I knew it would take a lot of time. I knew it would take a lot of digging for materials from the past finding photographs and so on and so forth, and interviews and so on. And I just didn't want to give up my time to do that, you know. I didn't think it was that important. But again, as I said, Kevin is very persuasive.
Plus, you're known as a guy that promotes others instead of yourself.
Exactly.
So what goes through your mind when you see yourself on screen, or like a couple minutes ago when you hear yourself on audio telling your own story? What goes through your mind?
Well, it's sort of like listening to someone else, not myself. You know, it's like, oh, that's an interesting guy, you know, but... Yeah. But it's not like like myself, actually. It's like listening to someone else.
You came to Kansas City in the mid-1960s as an instructor for the Kansas City Art Institute. Take us back. Tell us what the city was like back then through your eyes.
Well, the city was art-wise, and that's the part I know best, retarded. I'm sorry, folks, but there was no, even with our great museum, the Nelson Atkins, there was no art really in the city. And if there was art in the city, it was art of the past. No real contemporary work. There were a couple small galleries that were attempting, but for example, at the Art Institute, we didn't even have a gallery on campus for our students. And that's the real motivation that sent me out into the neighborhood to find a place. So I went over to Westport. And Westport had not yet been gentrified. And I got a very nice building on Westport and Broadway. And for $500 a month. And so I put my studio upstairs, and I put a gallery downstairs. And I started having shows of my, of our students' work and of my colleagues' work. And it was very successful because people really wanted to know. They didn't really know what the Kansas City Art Institute was. They thought it was a part of UMKC in those days. And that would have been okay, of course, but it wasn't. And so that gallery that I started was called the Broadway Gallery. Lasted for about 3 years, and or maybe it was two. And then they started gentrifying Westport. And so my rent went from $500 a month to like $5,000 a month. And I said, uh-oh, you know, I can't deal with that. And that's what really pushed me out of Westport and searching for a new place.
So if any of you real estate developers are listening, this man has the Midas touch in terms of gentrification, in terms of driving creative energy into a space. You just heard him say he came into Westport before it was gentrified, before it was Westport that was known today, and you moved next to an area once known as the Freight House District that we now know as the Crossroads. Talk about that.
Well, I didn't go there right away. I started looking in probably more obvious places, what was known as the River Key. It's now the Market District, and the Bottoms. And neither place really seemed to have what I thought we needed. And this whole time, I kept going through the Crossroads area, which was very, very run down. And one day, even the railroad station, you know, Union Station, was nothing. And they didn't know what... They were even talking about tearing it down. And I found out that the walls were too thick. It would cost so much to tear it down than to renovate it. Anyway, I kept going through this area, and it dawned on me one day, like, here it is, near Crown Center, and I knew that the Union Station would be developed eventually, and downtown, which needed developing. And I thought, perfect area. So I started looking there, and I found a building that I bought. I had already learned from the Westport, do not rent. Buy your building so they can't start gentrifying and kicking you out.
How is teaching art different from creating art?
Actually, I think they are very similar. For me, anyway. I taught rather uniquely. I made art with the students. I got in there, and I thought that the best way to teach is to make. And so I always tried to carve out a spot in the sculpture department where I taught and make my art. That doesn't mean I didn't teach, you know. Sometimes I taught by example. Here I am, your teacher, making art. And why in the hell aren't you making art? You're here to make art, you know.
Kansas City has been described by some as the city of clay. Do you feel that way? Is Kansas City the city of clay with you and its other ceramic artists?
Well, I think it's more than that. I think it has a history of clay. A lot of people don't know, but there was a great tile industry here before the plaza was built. And it was very wonderful. There's still a few buildings left on Troost and other places in the city that have this tile, and they're absolutely gorgeous. And again, excuse me, audience, but the plaza sort of put that business out of business because they went to Mexico and bought tiles. The plaza is full of Mexican tiles from, Puebla, Mexico. And it could get them cheaper. And they're very, very nice. But it really played an important role in putting our city out of the clay business. However, the Art Institute has played a major role in revitalizing the clay industry, not so much in the sense of buildings and so on, but we've had great teachers here. Ferguson, for example, was a phenomenal teacher of clay, and he built a program out there out of nothing when he was brought here in the 60s. And I modestly must admit that I contributed to that. And the other teachers in the clay department have all played an important role in bringing clay to Kansas City and from that spreading it around the country. Some of the most important teachers in the clay industry today, in pottery, for example, graduated from the Kansas City Art Institute.
So it is the city of clay.
Yes, it is.
In a sense.
Yeah, yes.
Our guest is the one and only Jim Leedy, and also here is Kevin McGraw of Cowbell Productions, the filmmaker behind Leedy, the documentary. It's been several years in the making and is premiering tomorrow, Friday, August 31st, at the Screenland Crossroads. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we talk more about the life of Jim Leedy, his experience as a war photographer in Korea, and hanging out with artistic icons such as Jackson Pollock. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Javelani LaFall. In the art world, there is, of course, what's known as expressionism and surrealism. But as for Jim Leedy, he says his work is lifetime search for realism, getting down to the real materials of stones, landscape, the birth of stars, and the universe. And our in-studio guest is that very same legendary Jim Leedy. We also have Kevin McGraw of Cowbell Productions, the filmmaking collective behind Leedy, the documentary. Several years in the making, screening Friday, August 31st, at the Screenland Crossroads. There is an additional 10 p.m. show. The 8 o'clock show, I understand, is sold out. That's how much admiration Mr. Leedy brings to the artistic community. Mr. Leedy, the film seems to suggest that you found inspiration in the clay pits and brick kilns in the Virginia and Montana towns where you grew up. Describe what your early life was like and your relationship to clay and brick and building.
My early life was in Virginia, and I lived about a half a mile from a brickyard. And in fact, there was a small train that ran in front of my house from the clay pits to the brickyard. And I used to hide behind bushes and jump on that that little train and ride it into town because it went right by my school in the morning. And that brickyard really played an important role. Not only did I have a lot of clay, because clay was really common there to play with, I would make little toys. And I got to know some of the workers at the brickyard, and they would shovel in a few of my little clay pieces and fire them for me. And then I had them to play with. I wish I'd kept some of them, like to have them today, just to remember that's where I started. But I had always loved clay. There was always a clay pit behind my house or whatever, and clay was very common in that part of the world, is very common, and it was just natural. And my mother told me that after I got grown, she said, "Jimmy, I know why you love clay so much." And I said, "Why is that, Mom?" And she said, "Well, when I was pregnant with you, I craved clay. And I secretly had a little ball of clay in the closet, and I'd go nibble on it." Now, no doubt, I mean,
wow.
We know that pregnant women do crave materials, and sometimes clay has the ingredients in it that they crave. Well, that's a nice story, but it is a true story.
Very metaphysical,
yeah.
As well. Speaking of clay, we have photos on Facebook from inside your studio where we have the clay vats and where everything is created and where paintings hang and everything that you've created and shaped can be seen and is on display and where you have your creative process. And Brinker writes, "Wow, the studio itself is a gallery. Congrats to Mr. Leedy for his artistic excellence and free-willing expression, and to him and his wife for preserving through a long creative career. You go, Jim," is what Brinker says on Facebook. Your life in perspective, you grew up, you was all state in football and basketball, which a lot of people might not know. Sort of a great American story. But your perspective on life and death changed forever when you became a military photographer.
Yes.
Tell us about that experience. How did you become that?
Well, you know, veterans don't like to talk about their war experiences because it brings back too vividly the experiences. And we try to forget those things. It's commonly known that veterans don't talk about it. There's a wonderful documentation now on World War II, because those veterans are dying by the thousands every year, and they finally will talk about it. And I'm the same way. You know, the Korean War was not, no war is a good war. And it was very, very, it was horrible. It was just horrible. And I was very lucky because of my experience as when I was in high school, I had been a photographer for a local newspaper, and that led me into being a military photographer, photojournalist. And people say, "Well, that was a good job. You didn't have to fight." And say, "Yeah, but I had to be right in the middle of everything."
And you were there.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You had to be into it.
You hear the saying, life imitates art and art imitating life. How does your life experience inform your artistic process? You were obviously there in the Korean War and you obviously have, as we went into your studio, there's a full wall of man's inhumanity to man. Mm-hmm. Skulls, skeletons, bodies, mm-hmm. almost mass graves drawn from the inspiration mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. those mass graves. But you created out of that madness. Tell mm-hmm. us about that.
Well, for many years, I had nightmares about some of the things I saw, not only in the war, but as a child, you know, relatives dying. I had a cousin who ran out in front of a car right in front of me. And that kind of thing, you never get out of your mind. And just generally, man's inhumanity to mankind, like the Holocaust, for example. You cannot be alive in the Western world and not know about that and not be concerned about it. And I saw that come vividly into reality in Korea. You know, I saw dead bodies even floating down the river and that sort of thing. And I had nightmares about that, as I said. And finally, Margaret Silva of the Hall family, who has a foundation, she and her colleagues gave me a grant to make a work of art. And I used that grant to build this wall. I got a commercial skeleton, broke it apart, made molds with the help of Larry Beckel, and who was the technician there at the time, and we cast those and turned it into a wall that's about 50 feet long and about 12 feet tall. And it's scary, but at the same time, it's beautiful. Because it tells us that war is ridiculous, but hopefully at the end of this wall, there's geese and birds trying desperately to get up out of the ground. And it says, you know, well, maybe we can still survive.
I looked at the piece that you just described, and it seems to lack the sort of inherent morbidity that you would think about with skulls and skeletons and bones. And sort of have more of an archaeological dig feel to it.
Exactly.
As if you were digging up ancient bodies mm-hmm. and skulls. Mm-hmm. That's how it struck me.
Thank you, because that's exactly what I wanted. It's like if you went into an area where mass killing was done and scooped up the earth and you found these, and there's nothing, in a way, more beautiful than discovering ancient artifacts, archaeology. And to me, it's more like that. But underneath that discovery, there's the horrible event. But you're right. I hope you're right that it does not overwhelm you. I must say one thing real quickly. When it first opened at Grand Arts, an Asian lady came in, and she looked at it, and she turned and ran out. And I was like, oh, my, this is not what I want. And so I ran after her, and I says, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean for you to be scared. And she says, oh, don't apologize. She says, I grew up in Korea, and I saw things like this out of my window as a child. And she says, thank you for doing the wall.
That definitely spoke to her in the way that it spoke to you and in the way that you
expressed it. She had to come back, of course, and see it. But the first impact, not knowing that it was there, was just too much to deal with immediately.
And for you, making the piece itself was sort of coming back and dealing with it as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Yes.
Now, you dabble in a lot of other things, ceramics, paintings, sculpture, academia, but you're also a musician, too. How does that approach to music different than painting and sculpting and all of your other endeavors? Tell us a little bit about that.
I think they're all the same creative drive. I think music. I didn't play music until I became a professor at the University of Montana, to be honest. And all my buddies there were playing folk music, and I'd go to there and I'd play the spoons. And oh man, I want to play an instrument. So I bought for $10 an old guitar that had been made in Mexico, and I put it behind my couch, and my son backed into it one day and broke it, and I repaired it, and so I started playing it. And I don't really feel that there is a difference in creativity between music or art making or writing. It's the same need to create and discover.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We're joined by the legendary Jim Leedy and Kevin McGraw of Cowbell Productions. There's a new film, Leedy the Documentary, several years in the making, premiering tomorrow, Friday, August 31st, at the Screenland Crossroads. Let's go to your time in New York as a student at Columbia. What was it like hanging out with Willem de Kooning, Jackson Pollock, and Franz Kline? Legends of arts. What was it like?
You know, it wasn't that fantastic at the time. I had already gone to college at VCU, which was then the College of William and Mary, actually. And I went to Columbia University to do graduate work, partially because I knew these guys were there, and partially because I got a scholarship to go there. But I spent my time in New York coming and going several years, and I would hang out at a place called the Cedar Bar, and that's where all of those artists came. Some of them even got free drinks and free food by trading their art to the owner of the Cedar Bar, and of course he became later enormously wealthy because of that. But it was great hanging out and just listening. I was this young artist. I did more listening than talking, of course, because I wanted to get into the spirit of what they were doing.
What are some of the things that you heard as a fly on the wall with these, what are considered now great artistic expressionist masters?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint because, you know, it was more of an overall learning experience, and it's hard to pinpoint. I do remember when I finally left to take a job, I told them that I was going to take a job teaching, and Bill de Kooning spoke up and said, "You can't do that. He says, you're too creative to do that." He says, "You know, teachers can't make art. Teachers teach. Only artists make art, you know." And I said, "Well, you know, Bill, you're the best teacher I've ever had just by sitting here and listening to you guys." And he sat back and he says, "Are you kidding me? Are you calling me a teacher?" And I thought he was going to jump my bones, you know. And I said, I said, "Yes, sir, you're a great teacher." And he got this weird look on his face and said, "Okay, maybe you should try teaching. But, you know, teach by making. Don't teach by telling."
I think experience is the best teacher, and I think you're a good example of that. And of course, you learned that from your great masters in Willem de Kooning and Jackson Pollock and all of that faculty there at Columbia. But you saw their work,
yes,
in painting the abstract expressionism that they were getting into at the time and becoming known for at the time. And you said, "Wait a minute, I don't want to do what they're doing. I'm a painter too, but I don't necessarily want to do what they're doing." So you became a ceramic abstract expressionist. Many argue one of the world's first. How did you get into ceramic abstract expressionism?
Well, as I've said earlier, I was always into clay. Even at BCU in Virginia, I took a ceramic class, and I always loved clay. And yes, you're right. it was very, very hard as a young painter, young artist, not to emulate these masters. The desire was to jump right in and be a part of it, but I knew that I had to find my own voice. Even, you know, I did not want to be Jackson Pollock. I did not want to be de Kooning. I wanted to be Jim Leedy. And because I had worked with clay all of my life, so to speak, and it was handy, I was at Columbia University, and I went over to Teachers College and got some clay, and I started making these things. And luckily, they didn't know what they were, but they allowed me to fire them in their electric kilns there. And looking back in retrospect, I guess they might be the first abstract expressionist ceramics. There are those who would disagree with that, but, you know, so what?
Indeed. What did your painting contemporaries, the action painting contemporaries that we just spoke about, Pollock and de Kooning, what did they think of the clay representations of that same type of aesthetic?
They weren't aware of it.
They weren't aware
of it. I was sort of doing that on the side on my own because I was this fly sitting at the table, listening more than talking, and going back to school and making these things, trying to find who am I, because that's what it's all about. You cannot, in my opinion, jump on someone else's bandwagon. You can become a part of a movement because that movement is an organic thing that is penetrating the space that you're in. But to jump on a bandwagon is to deny your own person.
But you also say that if you, as an artist, say that you're not influenced by anybody, whether it be your contemporaries or people who came before you, you're lying. Talk about that.
Being influenced is a natural thing. You can't, in my opinion, how can you be an island in an ocean that's full of other things going on, you know? You become a part of that ocean. You can't escape that. I like to think that that ocean is bigger than the time in which you're in. In the arts, for example, art has been going on since cave paintings. And it's important, I think, for an artist to know the history of art. Now, that's a historian talking, but I think it is true. I mean, artists like Picasso, for example, they were influenced by everything from cave painting to and Egyptian painting to their contemporaries like Matisse and so on. But they ingested it and discovered who they were. You can't not be influenced by, if you're alive and aware, by what's going on. But you have to find your own voice.
How did your relationship to the late, great Peter Voulkos shape your artistic vision?
Oh, fantastic.
Leedy Voulkos gallery that you mm-hmm. have down there
yeah.
in the Crossroads. How did your relationship to him shape your vision?
Oh, in many, many ways. Peter Voulkos was a genius. There's no doubt about that. And his colleague and my colleague for many years when I taught at the University of Montana, Rudy Audio, was equally important. These two guys, I found out when I went to teach at the University of Montana that these guys were doing what I dreamed to do and probably was doing myself in a minor way. But Peter Voulkos had this personality and skill that everybody wanted to be Peter Voulkos. It's sort of like Jackson Pollock. Everybody wanted to be Jackson Pollock, you know. And there are many, many, many Jackson Pollock imitators out there that who the hell are they, you know. And a lot of people followed Voulkos that way. He was a phenomenal. You know, he was the kind of guy that would walk into a bar, for example, and have a few drinks, and had such a personality that when he would leave, everybody in there would say, "Hey, bye, Pete. It's nice seeing you." No one knew him when he walked in. He had that kind of magnetic quality about him.
A lot of your work is influenced by Asia and Asian aesthetics.
Yeah.
You have an upcoming trip to China. What do you plan to do while you're over there?
Well, this time I hope to be something of a tourist. Now, we want to go to places, Molly and my wife, that we haven't been before. The guy that is inviting us there was an assistant, sort of, when I was there, one of my trips. Or not an assistant, I take that back. He is an artist, but he came to where I was working and was highly influenced by what I was doing. Not imitating again. He's a smart man. And I'm going back, and I'm hoping that we will not collaborate, but make an exhibition that will show in, say Shanghai or Beijing.
What's your advice to up-and-coming Kansas City artists? We have on Twitter, Sculptor KC. Sculptor KC is his name. Tweets, what advice do you have for an artist with work and skills to break into KC galleries?
First of all, before you break into galleries, you have to be an artist.
Right.
You know, by that I mean you really have to know thyself. That's a statement said many hundreds of years ago, and it's still true. You've got to discover who you are, even as a young artist, and therefore you have, by knowing who you are and having that come through your work, you are different. You might be similar to other artists because you are a product of the time in which you're in, but in order to be unique, you have to know who you are, know thyself, and then that is what galleries are looking at, that looking at uniqueness and originality.
You have paint on your hands right now from a
yes.
painting last night. Can you describe what you were working on in your studio?
Yes, I can. I move through instinct, you know. One thing leads to another thing, leads to another thing, and I rarely ever plan what I'm going to do. As I've said before, I let the material tell me what to do. But in this instant, I wanted to return to something that I've done before, and that is subject matter. And I love animals. The elephants are something that if we let the elephants, for example, be destroyed or lost, I think that's symbolic of the loss of the whole civilized world, you know? And so I thought I'll do an elephant. And I worked on an elephant last night.
Elephants never forget.
That's right.
Kevin McGraw, what are the next steps for the Jim Leedy the documentary, after this local premiere tomorrow?
Well, I think what we're going to try to do, I think this is probably, tomorrow night will be probably the last opportunity for people to see it. So what we're trying to do really is we're trying to, and thankfully for Screenland, that they're going to let us show a 10 o'clock showing, which is great. So we'll be able to do some different stuff later. We're hoping that KCPT will air the film. We just haven't announced a date yet. It's just not going to be this September. We've talked to Stretch at Grinders, and he has a Sunday night movie thing that he does. So I think we're going to show that sometime in the fall when it's nice and cool at night. And then there's a drive-in theater that Jim's daughter Stephanie knows about. I don't know where it is yet, and we haven't really clearly discussed it, but we are in the spirit of the old blowout Art Institute parties, we're going to do a barrel burning and have a drive-in theater, and everyone's welcome to come for nothing to celebrate Jim.
Barrel burning without the G. That's how much it's going to burn.
That's it.
So you're doing the Kickstarter thing to kind of on a completed film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it to break even with the costs of it?
Well, the main thing is there's a lot of hard costs that we still have incurred in the last couple of years. One of the major things that Matt and I've talked about is the closed captioning that's a requirement for KCPT, and there's rights and stuff that you have to have all signed off on, and all that stuff costs money, and making the DVDs is going to cost money, and so we're just hoping that we can get this thing funded through Kickstarter and do those things, and Matt has a great idea of doing a director's cut. All that stuff takes extra funding and time, and the sweeting that it takes because it's HD is more expensive than standard definition. So a lot of those things that cost money that we have not been able to pay for, that's what we're hoping to get this funding for.
And the link to that Kickstarter account, as well as photos of Jim Leedy's studio, are on our website at kcur.org. Be sure to go check that out. Our guests are, as I mentioned before, the legendary and remarkable Jim Leedy, along with Kevin McGraw of Cowbell Productions, the filmmaking collective behind Leedy the Documentary, all about the life of this extraordinary man, several years in the making, premiering tomorrow, Friday, August 31st, at the Screenland Crossroads. Mr. Leedy, thank you for coming.
Thank you, and I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Matt and Kevin and all of those who played a role.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
And tune in tomorrow as Monroe Dodd stops by for another look at historical events that shape our present. This week, it's the Vietnam War. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi, who is headed to Australia to film a documentary on the origins of Outback Steakhouse. Central Standards is executive produced by Bill Anderson with help from Tamika Weatherspoon. Kim Noble is our announcer, and Emily Mutert manages our website at kcur.org. The intro music is by Miles Bonney. The outro you're hearing right now is by The Wilnots. Up to Date is next with more TEDx KC speakers. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.